me paint a picture of what's waiting for you on the ship. You arrive in America, land of opportunity, milk and honey, and guess what? You all get to be slaves. Split up, sold off, and worked to death. The lucky ones get Sunday off to sleep, but they make most days and all for what? For cotton, indigo, for a fucking purple shirt. The only good news is the tobacco your grandkids are gonna farm for free is gonna give a shitload of these white motherfuckers cancer. And I ain't even started.
Hello and welcome to Storm of Spoilers. You could probably tell by the sound of my voice that this is not an ordinary Storm of Spoilers episode because it is Joanna. It is I, Joanna Robinson, speaking and not Dave Gonzalez. We are going to be doing for 8 weeks some bonus Storm of Spoilers episodes tied to the new Star series, American Gods. You guys asked for it. We are going to deliver it. But since if you listened to our regular Storm of Spoilers American Gods episode, you will know that A, my regular podcast host, Neil Miller, has not read the book and was just mostly confused by the episode. And B, Dave Gonzalez hates American Gods and didn't want to be forced to talk about it. So if you hear that lovely laughter on the other end of the line, that is the sound of my very best friend in this whole world, actually, Gail Folsom. Say hello to the people, Gail.
Hi. Nice to be on the podcast.
I have forced Gail. No, I barely had to twist your arm, right? I have forced Gail to commit to this 2-month endeavor because as much as I consider myself a mythology nerd, Gail Folsom knows 10,000 times more about mythology than I do. And as much as I consider myself a Neil Gaiman nerd, Gail Folsom knows at least a little bit more about Neil Gaiman than I do.
I was there first.
Okay. So Gail and I are going to be one of the reasons we're doing this episode is because, as I said, you guys asked for it. But the other reason is the major feedback I'm getting from people who are trying to watch the show without reading the book is that they are confused. So Gail and I, two nerdy mythology and Gaiman-loving people, are going to try to run through these episodes and help explain what's going on. And then for those of you who have read the book, who don't need things explained, we're going to also just sort of look at the episode itself and the adaptation process. And I think there's going to be something in these episodes for everyone. Before we dive into this episode, season one, episode one, The Bone Orchard, we wanted to talk a little bit about, well, I want to find out from Gail sort of her relationship with American Gods, her relationship with Neil Gaiman. Gail Folsom, when did you first read American Gods? What's your relationship with this story?
Well, my relationship with Neil began many years ago. I read, I think the first thing I ever read by Neil Gaiman was probably Sandman. And I mean, from the first pages, it was immediately clear that this was a person who had many of the same interests that I did from obviously a very young age. So one of the great things about American Gods is that it brings together a lot of things that exist in, a lot of Neil Gaiman's work. It's sort of like this mythology ultimate ensemble cast. And so it's just a perfect example, I think, of how Neil Gaiman relates to fairy tale and mythology, which is he has this sort of like personal friendship with these characters, and he assigns qualities to them that definitely exist within their own personal mythologies, you know, throughout history. But he also brings them to life in a really cool way. And American Gods that's the perfect example of sort of how I feel about a lot of these characters having grown up reading mythology instead of, you know, normal books like a kid.
going outside or whatever it is that whatever. Kids did.
Who knows?
So you read the book when it first came out, thereabouts?
I did. I read the book when it first came out, and I actually went, I actually saw Neil Gaiman speak about it at a local bookstore, and even gave him a piece of fan art, which he was very nice about. That was a long time ago, though. I don't do that kind of thing anymore.
right. We're grown-ups now. We don't do that.
We're grown-ups. Mm-hmm. But it was wonderful, actually, to hear his personal thoughts on this particular book. And here, you know, there was a certain amount of, like, apocryphal information that also he talked about. Because you will, as those of you who are confused from watching the show will know, there are a lot of obscure characters that he brings in. But one of the really cool things I think about this book is that pretty much everybody who's mentioned in the book ever, like almost every single minor character, is actually some reference to some piece of lore from somewhere around the world. So it's, like I said, it's just like this really great ultimate cast of everybody from every culture too, joined together in Neil Gaiman's fertile imagination.
So Gail and I will be watching American Gods week to week, and Gail is rereading the book along with the show, which, as she mentioned to me before we started recording, was pretty easy with the first episode because it's a pretty faithful adaptation, but things are going to get a little weirder as we go forward. And the way that spoilers, I know this is on the Storm of Spoilers feed, but the way that spoilers are going to work on this show is we are going to be spoiling, quote unquote, everything leading, like including the episode we're talking about. So all these spoilers in this episode are going to be contained to season one, episode one. However, if you've listened to me on the Game of Thrones podcast, Cast of Kings, you know that what we're going to be trying to do is walk like a tightrope of trying to infuse and our book knowledge and any extra knowledge we have into sort of illuminating the episode without tipping our hat entirely to what's coming. So hopefully this will be a good companion series. If you guys have feedback for us, questions for us, you can reach us at stormofspoilers@gmail.com. You can tweet at me, I'm at Joe Wrote This. And Gail, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is Clockwork Rose.
At Clockwork Rose. So there's no underscore in that or anything, right?
There is not.
Okay. So you can tweet at us or email us or tweet at the Storm of Spoilers Twitter feed if you have any questions about an episode. If something particularly confuses you in an episode and we feel like we could help you understand what it is, being the amateur experts that we are. So we are going to start. Well, I guess before we get down, we're going to do sort of like a scene-by-scene breakdown. But before we get there, Gail, I was just wondering, like, what was your initial impression of the first episode watching it?
You know, well, obviously, I thought it was extremely faithful to the first, like, chapter or two of the book. And it was really interesting to see it sort of brought to life, because I had not even considered that there would be a soundtrack element to the telling of this story. And they had a very interesting soundtrack choice, which was this, like, consistent saxophone line that was, you know, this slightly sleazy sounding sax that was, you know, crept into a lot of the scenes, and it was very atmospheric. But it had an American twang to it, you know, sort of a jazz era American twang. And it was really a good introduction. They definitely threw in some characters pretty quickly. I'm sure to sort of, you know, break up the action and garner interest in what was going on. But, I mean, the one thing I will say, I really liked the way that, the lead actor, and this, by the way, this is something you'll discover about me pretty quickly. I don't know anyone's name.
I can help.
Thank you.
Ricky Whittle.
Thank you. I think he's doing a really good job of portraying Shadow, and I think he's very sympathetic. He did a really good job interpreting that first really dreadful set of circumstances. There's a great fatalism in the first episode.
Yeah.
Which runs through, you know, which runs through the story, in my opinion. But yeah, it was I heard a lot of people say it was really dark. And Yeah, I mean, I guess it was. It was.
Well, yeah,
a lot of people died.
Let's kick off with the fact that this episode starts with what's called in the book the like coming to America vignettes, right? Mm-hmm. This isn't one from the book, but we'll get them throughout the series, and they're occasionally isolated. Sometimes they loop back, you know, characters will return back into the plot, but basically occasionally we will see a story of an old world god coming to America in some way or another, transported by the faith of these immigrants from various countries and cultures across the world. And we start with a pack of Vikings. And if you want to talk about dark, I feel like the show wastes no time in letting you know that there will be blood. There will be fonts and geysers of it. More than a human body can hold. And so we see these Vikings sort of rip each other to shreds all in the
name. I was so impressed that one Viking managed to actually, like, cut a man in half. I was like, wow, these are Vikings. Like, I haven't seen them before. I mean, half of a man's body, like, lifted up in the air and just fountains of blood. And then I liked the one arm just arcing over, like, even slightly out of frame.
Well, yeah, I mean, I know you're a fan of Pushing Daisies, and we know that Brian Fuller can do, like, morbid things. Showrunner Brian Fuller can do morbid things very beautifully, as he did on Hannibal and Pushing Daisies and his other shows. So, yeah, we get some beautiful, beautiful carnage.
Honestly, it was, and like you said, it was not part of the book originally, and it was so extreme. I was sort of expecting we would have, like, some kind of, I don't know, Valhalla-esque, like, putting back together of people. It was just, the carnage was so scattered, but yeah.
But so the point of the scene, and I think sort of the Bill Quist scene that we get later, and we'll talk about this throughout the series, but the point of this is that, you know, and this is true of any non-kitty mythology that you read, gods demand worship and sacrifice, right? And so this is a blood demand that the god of these Vikings, who is Odin, a war god, needs blood and carnage before he will give them what they want, which is a strong wind enough to fill their sails. And so, you know, the lesson we can take away from this first thing is, first of all, this is a way that Odin was brought to the New World, was through these Vikings. And he is not a very nice god necessarily all the time. So would you agree? Is there more to be gleaned from this cold open?
No, I think that's spot on. Like, you have to understand who you're dealing with early on, especially because, you know, like in the mythology, Odin is a war god, you know, and the Vikings were a very warlike people, but he's also actually the god who taught humanity how to have nice manners and be hospitable. So there's an interesting dichotomy to Odin as a god, and I think that the actor who I love,
Ian McShane.
Thank you, Ian McShane.
It's gonna be a fun game. I like it.
Not kidding. Like, I really don't know names, but I think he's doing a very good job. Ian McShane is, I think, very charming, and I really love watching him perform. But it's a good introduction, I believe, to this particular character within the story, because yeah, he is charming and he's likable despite the fact that Shadow says he doesn't like him for good reasons.
So this is where we should talk about you know, something that, you know, we're going to try to avoid, like, massive plot spoilers, but something we're not going to be precious about is, like, who these god characters are, because all of this is a tricky thing that the show has had to do, because all of the marketing leading up to the show has made viewers very aware that this is a show about gods. But would you agree with me that in the book, you might have cottoned on because you know Norse mythology very well. So when you meet a character named Mr. Wednesday, you're like, oh, Odin's Day, that's Odin. But, you know, other people who, like me, who grew up with Greek mythology instead of Norse mythology, might not have grokked immediately to, like, which gods they're meeting when, you know? So Gil and I will always tell you which god you've just met. That's a degree of spoilers we are going to give you. But that is a challenge of the show. The book, I think, really was, you know, Shadow meets this weird character. Mr. Wednesday. And, you know, I don't think every reader is supposed to know immediately that he's Odin, right?
No. And actually, like, I'll be straight with you. Like I said, I read this book and then watched Neil, and this is, I don't know, back early aughts. I read the book, watched Neil Gaiman talk about it. And he was the one who pointed out that Wednesday comes from Odin's Day, from Woden's Day. And we've got a few days of the week that are named after Norse gods. And there's actually, like, Neil Gaiman sort of slides a little joke in there in the first chapter when he's talking about, you know, Mr. Wednesday says, oh, it's today. Today is my day after all. And then he looks out the window and there's like thunder and lightning outside. And he goes, although maybe, you know, like Thursday would be more appropriate or something like that. So there's like a little joke in there.
Thursday. Awesome. that's so great. So we should rewind a little bit and just say that we meet Shadow when he's still in the joint, and he's interacting with his cellmate, and he gets the good bad news that he's being let out early because his wife, his beloved wife, Laura, has been killed in a car accident. And then he goes to the airport. He sees Mr. Wednesday for the first time. Mr. Wednesday is pulling a delightful con job on the flight desk agent, who hasn't wanted to pull a con job in order to get themselves in first class. And then we get the scene where Shadow meets Mr. Wednesday on the plane. This to me, and I've said this elsewhere, but this to me is like the highlight of the episode. And I think, you know, for the ups and downs of this episode of American Gods, this plane scene is like the very, very best, I think, that it has to offer. Just because they're, you know, the leash is off Ian McShane. He's chewing up every word that they give him. you know, and Ricky Whittle, I think, as Shadow Moon, is, things haven't gotten so weird yet that we need to worry that Shadow is just taking things too calmly. Because I think eventually I will have that complaint in this episode. But in this flight, he's just sort of like, all right, who's this weird guy? I don't know. So what did you think of this flight scene?
I loved it. I mean, I when I first saw the casting for American Gods, I was like, oh yeah, Ian McShane is Odin. That's going to be awesome. And I there's a quote from the book about from that scene when Shadow is looking at Mr. Wednesday and he's smiling, and or I think it's actually it's slightly later, but it's in the first, like, getting to know Mr. Wednesday few scenes where he smiles, and Shadow remembers reading at one point that, like, chimpanzees and great apes, they smile, they bare their teeth when they're actually, like, showing aggression.
Ooh, yeah.
And I loved Ian McShane is very good at a sort of, not violent, but yeah, he has a kind of aggressive aspect to him, and he was really, you know, doing a great power play during that scene. And I'm interested to hear you say that you were eventually during this episode, you think that Shadow is sort of not really being very human about his responses and maybe taking things a little bit too much in stride for what's going on. Because that character, he's such an odd character, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, Gaiman writes him so intentionally obscurely. Like, you never know what he looks like. There's even, like, a vague reference in the early book to – the early part of the book to, like, where are you from? Like, what's your ethnicity? And it's never answered.
He's the only, like, physical –
ultimate human being. He just doesn't – you know, there's no identifying or there's no culture to him. There's no place.
They say coffee and cream skin is the only, like, physical, real, like, in his size. Like, he's a big guy, but like,
big, yeah.
But like, coffee and cream skin is the only sort of, like, the closest they get to nailing down his ethnicity. And I think intentionally, and I think, well, I know Neil Gaiman has spoken about the casting of Ricky Whittle was important because he does kind of look like he could be from everywhere at once, you know? So I think they made a little more specific in the episode. Mr. Wednesday says something about your mom with her afro or something like that, but like, which is more specific than the book ever gets, but they still sort of allow Shadow to be this melting pot. And I agree with you that I think in the book, because you're seeing everything from Shadow's perspective, I've talked about this elsewhere, but I think Gaiman does leave Shadow very intentionally blank in the book so that he can be sort of this like vessel for you, the reader, to ride, you know, and so that you can sort of lay whatever you want onto him. And that obviously can't work in a TV show the same way.
Yeah.
So, you know, I like Ricky Whittle a lot, but they are going to have to make some adaptive changes in terms of, and I, you know, I think already, you know, when we see him sort of screaming into the abyss, like his sorrow and stuff like that, like that's already more personality, I think, than Shadow gets. Yeah. And that's not a knock on the book. I think it's a very intentional choice and it's fine, but it's already more personality. But he's still like, my question for you is, like, do you think Shadow is the kind of person who, like, believes that there are paranormal or divine things in the world, and that's why he's just sort of like, oh, you're a leprechaun, that's fine? Or is he just preternaturally calm and just sort of
watching him? Watching his performance, like, this is how I'm projecting onto Ricky Whittle's performance right now. I feel like, you know, especially like those early scenes in the prison where he keeps talking about, and it's in the book as well, but he has this sense of foreboding and he, you know, he says he can smell snow and it just, you know, there seems like it's a storm coming. And there's that scene, you know, where he's looking up into the ceiling and he can see his wife, and there's a, sort of a premonition. There's a fatalism in it. Everybody who's watching the show goes, well, this is going to end poorly. You know, I feel like, I feel like the way that he and the writers have portrayed Shadow is someone who is resisting a deep feeling that there is some kind of fate in store for him, or, you know, and he talks about being in prison in the sense of relief, like something isn't chasing him anymore, like they got him so he can relax. And I mean, like, I feel like that character is struggling with a belief in the supernatural that he would like to deny. And so, yeah, the preternatural calm that he's displaying, that's how I read that, is if I just hold very still,
it will go. None of this is actually happening. I'll wake up. Laura will still be alive. It'll be fine. no, I like that explanation. I was also sort of floating this idea elsewhere that because the way that Neil Gaiman writes stories, no matter where they're set or when, he writes in the, like, the lingua franca of mythology and legend. And and when you read mythology, you don't really get very deep into these characters, right? These are, are, like, bare bones, like, I wouldn't even call them, like, thinly sketched or whatever, but they're just sort of down to their essence characters.
They're archetypal.
Yeah, exactly. Archetypal. Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, Shadow, it's not a spoiler to say that Shadow is on a very typical hero's journey in this story. And so what you have here is, like, a hero. And whatever that means to you, whatever that winds up meaning in this series and in the book, but, like, you know, here is our hero. He is going to meet some strange and unusual creatures and figures on his,
you walk
on
into
his journey.
A bar.
Yeah.
This man has a quest for you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, I understand that, like, some people who are watching the episode who are used to the Game of Thrones approach, where you have a medieval setting, but you have sort of more modern types of characters. You know, a complaint they've heard is they're just, like, a little put off by, they don't feel like Shadow is a very developed character. Whereas those of us who know him from the book are like, oh, this is fathoms deeper than we ever got from Shadow in the book, to be honest with you. So, do you know what I mean? So,
and to that, I would add that, in my opinion, the Shadow, while he's sort of the vessel, he's who we're going to be with, like, we're in his pocket, so to speak, but he's just a vehicle for showcasing these extraordinary characters who are, like, in my, the way that I think about a lot of these mythological characters is really that they are, you know, in Greek mythology and Norse mythology are really good examples, especially for Western culture. They are personality facets of all human beings, sort of, as you said, distilled down to their essence. So you have jokers and liars and tricksters, and you have people who are, you know, and you have beauty and love, and you have nobility, and you have strength, all these things sort of distilled down into people who behave predictably, so yeah, when you're reading, you know, sort of base mythology, it has a simplistic language. And and it's interesting because I think like Gaiman has sort of turned the tables in this particular story, because it's really like ourselves, the humanity in shadow, that's sort of boiled down to the sort of basic, well, this is happening now kind of like way of going through life, because we have in the end so little control. I mean, over like things that happen, acts of God, so to speak. But it's the gods and the myths who are these flamboyant, exceptional characters. And it's really, I mean, like it's sort of, you know, just like split personalities of humanity. If that's who Shadow is, then he's the one just sort of like watching the world go by.
Right.
Trying to figure out how he's going to survive it like everybody else.
Yeah. And the long-term question for me is someone who hasn't read the book and is just watching the show, are they going to respond to Shadow as a character? And I'm just going to be really interested to find out. I do think that Ricky Whittle is doing a good job, but you know, I'm just interested. It's a real hill to climb for this adaptation. So,
yeah.
And
I would say, like, you know, Gaiman's writing has gotten even more Spartan. He's very, very skilled at it. So it reads really well off the page, because you're just sort of automatically putting yourself in that position. But you're absolutely right. It's very different to watch it.
Right. And you don't get great things like apes baring their teeth. Yeah, Ian McShane's menacing charm is just sort of like this. It's just part, like, I really can't think of anyone better for this part. So,
and you know, I love the sort of oblique references that he makes, and the sort of like tongue in cheek jokes. Like, he doesn't really care if you get it.
He's like,
you don't mean anything to him.
He's amused, so that's all that matters. He keeps himself amused. So then we, you know, we move to this very dramatic set piece, which is Jack's Crocodile Bar, which is
that was awesome.
Is it what you envisioned when you were reading the book? There isn't like a massive crocodile.
No, not at all. Yeah, like yeah. I thought, I was like, are they in New Orleans? Like, what happened here? This is an amazing. And like the camera's traveling down, and I was like, they're in a bar. Nope, it's a mouth. Are they in the mouth? Are we going to see the outside of this? Oh, you look, there it is.
Yeah, each tooth is a light. Awesome. It's like whatever it is, you know. And so Shadow is being stalked by Mr. Wednesday, because Mr. Wednesday is there as well. He seems to know more about Robbie than even Shadow does. Well, he definitely does, and he claims this because he read it in the paper. But is that why? We'll find out. And then we meet Matt Sweeney, the leprechaun, played by Pablo Schreiber. The first thing I want to say is that originally a British actor was cast to play this role, Sean Harris. He like was cast. I think he even shot some things. Like, and I don't know why he didn't work out. Sean Harris is a great actor. He's in Mission Impossible: Rogue Nation and. I think the Borgias. He's been in a bunch of stuff. But they cast Pablo Schreiber instead, who is an American. And they put this crazy rockabilly mohawk on him.
I did like the mohawk. Although, like, yeah, I don't know. The mohawk was, I was like, I guess I was sort of like, I guess we're going for sort of a woady kind of, like, that kind of leprechaun. I don't know. That doesn't. Does that apply? Anyway.
Yeah, no, I like that.
I like the mohawk.
I like the woad. But a lot of people have been complaining about his accent. And since you freshly read that chapter, you will know that there's a part in that chapter where, you know, Shadow says, you don't have an Irish accent. And the leprechaun, Matt Sweeney, says, yeah, I've been here too fucking long. Like, you know, and so
I think it's Southern comfort, too. Like, he's a hillbilly.
Yeah, he is. So I like that Matt Sweeney has this, like, muddy, Pablo Schreiber is doing, whether intentionally or not, is doing this weird, like, muddy Irish accent, American accent thing. Because, you know, one thing that the show doesn't do a great job of, but you know, hopefully we can explain on this podcast, is that these, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but these aren't like the original gods. Mm-hmm. These are sort of like American photocopies of the original gods, and so they're like Americanized. Yeah, and go ahead.
I don't want to get too far into sort of the, you know, the end game here, but yeah, there's, you know, they're here, and I'll say, you know, maybe what Neil Gaiman said when I heard him talking, which was, this doesn't seem to be a place that is very fertile for gods. Like, you know, and it's in the first pages of the book, these gods, you know, this is a country of a lot of different cultures coming together over a long period of time, or, you know, a relatively short period of time, actually, comparatively. And, the gods that they had in the old country, or the stories they had in the old country, just really didn't seem to make it over. And he kind of turns that on its ear a bit when you hear him talk about Anansi boys, because, you know, Br'er Rabbit comes out of South African gods. But at the same time, you bring these stories over and they don't keep the same strength that they had from wherever they came from. They become just stories. And you don't have to believe in a story to find it enjoyable. And like, you know, I think in this first episode, they talked quite a bit about like belief. And it's clear, you know, if these are gods walking around, nobody believes in them. Like, they don't worship them automatically. It has to be earned and fought for, and that's not how gods traditionally do.
Right. They're used to not having to work so hard for their worship. I think that's a great point. But the point is that the reason that Mr. Wednesday doesn't speak with any kind of Nordic accent, and the reason why the leprechaun sounds like we're from wherever he's from, is you know, because there are these like weird diluted American versions of these old world gods, right?
And to your quote from the book about being here too fucking long, Odin would have been basically the first. I mean, you know, compared to the gods who would have existed in the U.S. territories for longer, obviously a new god, but. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty well documented that the Vikings came over here way back. So in that respect, he wouldn't have any accent left. He's been here the longest out of the newcomers. So yeah,
thoroughly Americanized. Yeah,
I'm onto. I'm into your explanation of Pablo's muddy accent. That's kind of cool. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt and say he was doing it on purpose.
Yeah, sure. Why not? We get Mad Sweeney pulling coins out of the air, which is like a really fun effect. My problem with this scene, and I didn't like having a problem with the scene, but my problem with this scene is I felt like either the pacing or the sound mix was a little off. That just like something, like either the music was too loud or something, like just kept it from really landing the way that I wanted it to. All the major things are communicated. We've got a leprechaun here. He pulls coins out of the air. We've got Shadow losing a coin toss and sort of getting drafted into service. We've got him drinking mead, which is a sort of a rite, a ritual, right?
I have to say, that was the one part of the scene that I really liked, that they cut down to the basic essence right out of the original story, which is, you know, the three is a very magical Western number. It's in a lot of cultures, actually. Three is a really significant number. So, you know, I can't remember what the first one was, but the second one seals the deal and the third is the charm. I thought that was spot on. That was perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
Within the larger scene, which, yeah, was problematic.
and then we get this fight between Shadow and Mad Sweeney, which Shadow wins, and which means he gets to keep the gold coin. And so he is now Mr. Wednesday's, his man, his aide-de-camp, I think is what he said, his castellan. And what are some of the rules? Do you remember that Shadow lays out of like what he will and won't do for Mr. Wednesday? I don't mean this is a test.
He won't be paid to hurt people unless they are threatening to hurt Mr. Wednesday. Okay. So yeah, he's not a hitman. Right. He's a bodyguard, essentially. And a potentially an errand boy. I think he says that later too.
And then we have Shadow returning to his hometown to his wife's funeral. We have him, you know, seeing his wife's best friend and Robbie's wife, who's also very bereaved. And then we find out why she's so bereaved. because Robbie and Laura were having an affair, and they died in the car while Laura was giving Robbie head. So, not the most out there sexual moment of the episode, but you know. So
not the most depicted either.
No. So what did you think of the service and then the like the graveyard scene afterwards, which is a I would say significant expansion on the book.
Yeah, that's a significant deviation. Mm-hmm. And actually, I thought that was there were a number of choices they made in the first episode that were sort of more empathetic or humanizing than in the book. Like it, you know, for those people who thought that the first episode was dark, read the first chapter of the book. It's significantly colder in a lot of different respects. And so I liked seeing, okay.
It's Audrey Burton is the character's name.
Yeah. Oh. You can cut this if you want.
Oh.
I will say that despite the fact that I really liked her performance, I thought she did, first of all, it's hard to play drunk, and I thought she did a good job. Mm-hmm. And I also thought that she was empathetic. I felt badly for her, even if she was behaving badly. But I thought she was much more empathetic than she was in the book, and I thought that was a good thing because it gave Shadow a chance to make a decision. Do you, you know, just write this person off, push her away, and, you know, be alone in your grief, or are you going to give a little comfort even at a time when you don't really feel like giving anybody comfort? Mm-hmm. I thought it was good.
And I think it's part of the further humanizing effort of Shadow, like making Shadow a more dimensional character. And I think that graveyard scene, which I think is wholly invented, is
nearly.
Nearly wholly invented, is is sort of the most human behavior, I think, from him in the whole episode.
Yeah.
So, you know, I thought that was interesting. But sort of, and then we see him throw Matt Sweeney's coin and it sinks into Laura's grave, ominously, whatever. I don't know if this happens here, but I just have it in my show notes here, so this is where we're going to talk about it. Speaking of weird sexual whatever, we should talk about Bilquis, which is...
We need to talk about
Bilquis. We need to talk about Kevin and Bilquis. So the Bilquis scene, obviously sort of the showstopper of the episode. We see this goddess who is, you know, the Queen of Sheba is sort of what Bilquis is. And, lure an unsuspecting poor internet dater in the book. She's a prostitute and he's a very rude John in this, so you're not sorry at all about what happens to him. And this, you're like actually quite sad for this guy. Cause he's like, we don't have to do this. And I like you so much. And let's see each other more. And she's like, yeah, we will. Sure. That's fine. You know,
she had like there was like a fleeting moment of sadness that crossed her face when he was like, my kids talked me into this. And she was like,
That was their first mistake.
But we still gotta do what we
gotta do. And then we see this, like, incredible trickery, visual trickery, that involved, like, a trap door in the bed and some CGI, and Bilquis sort of devours him. I think all of us who read the book... I mean, when I read this book for the first time, and that scene is literally in the first chapter of the book, and when I read that, I was like... I think maybe that was the first Neil Gaiman I had read. No, it wasn't. But I was certainly like, oh my, what have I gotten myself into? My goodness, it's very graphic. Yeah. And then I was like, how on earth are they going to do this in the show? Are they going to do it? Are they going to cut it? And so kudos to them for doing it, for just going for it, I think. And I think it was extraordinarily well done. What did you think of Bilquis?
I loved her. In the book, she is... Again, it's this sort of cold scene. You're not at all distressed at what happens to this guy. You're sort of impressed that he makes an about face because he starts off being like, yeah, whatever, don't talk. And then he sort of is entranced and amazed and worshipful of her. But it was, I thought it was, frankly, for the direction that the show has headed in, I thought it was better than just transcribing exactly what happened in the book. I thought it was good to have a little pathos for this guy. And also, I mean, you had pathos for Bilquist too, because one thing that they put into the show that is not in the book is that she's sort of rejuvenated by this experience. Like, she looks at herself in the mirror and she's youthful and glowing. And she has this comment that she asks him earlier on, you know, when they're talking at the bar, she says, "You don't think I look spent?" And so there's a, you know, a humanity and a humility to her as well that I think is going to serve that character well.
I believe in the book she has this scene and then one other scene, and that's it for Bilquist. That's curtains for Bilquist. But I've been told that she has an expanded role in the show, as does Mad Sweeney, actually. So, you know, she... They put more dimension in this scene. She's not a straight out villain, and he's not, and he's not the worst, you know, he's not a terrible, like, guy that you're happy to see. There's a lot of pathos, a lot of tragedy in it, but it also, it feeds back into a couple things you're saying, like the Viking cold open and sort of what you were saying about Mad Sweeney and this being an unfriendly place for gods, is that these gods do have to cajole or trick or something the worship out of these Americans, these ungrateful Americans who have forgotten them, you know? Otherwise, they will fade, like Bilquist is fading, right? So
it was funny because the first time that we see Ian McShane in the episode, you know, he's conning this woman at the airport, and he's putting on, like, you know, for the God King, the all-seeing and all-knowing King of the Norsemen, it's an embarrassing display. Like, what he is doing, the debasing himself for an upgrade to first class. You know, like, that's not Odin-like. And while he doesn't do that in that exact scene in the book, that is a thing that his character does in the book at a later point within those first couple of chapters. And Shadow makes note of it, and yeah, it's telling about that character, because, I mean, who does that? Like, what self-respecting god would debase themselves like that just to get their way? And frankly, you know, Bilquist does it with more dignity than that. Yeah, that first introduction to Odin, where he's just doing it for his own comfort.
But so it's a visually arresting scene, and I can see why people who haven't read the book, like, watch it and they're like, well, that's a crazy, insane Brian Fuller thing that I just watched happen, Neil Gaiman thing, I guess, that I just watched happen. But I can also understand they're like, what does it mean? And so hopefully that sort of better explains why it's there, why it's important that it's there early.
Yeah,
and sort of what it means. It's not just to shock you. It's a little bit to shock you, but it's also a little bit to shock you.
But it's also, like you said, with the first scene with the Vikings, I thought it was well placed, because it makes it clear that the old gods that real humans really worshipped, I mean, people really did kill each other for them, kill strangers, do it in a painful way on purpose, because they truly believed that that was what their gods wanted. And they gave up things, and people still do that for religion. They sacrifice things, possessions, you know, actions, all kinds of stuff. It's a facet of humanity. So in those early days of worship and the idea of divinity, yeah, people did what we would consider dreadful things for gods. And that's what I think he's trying to make clear, and what the show is trying to make clear, is that we're not talking about, like, some vague notion of, like, you know, giving up candy for Lent or whatever. Sorry. But this is, like, you know, talking about, like, ultimate sacrifices. And I thought that Viking vignette was a great way to intro the show, as much as, you know, it was just like buckets of blood gushing out of people's heads. But also, yeah, the Bilquist scene with its pathos is about, yeah, it's about giving up everything. I mean, he says that any number of times throughout the scene.
that's a perfect way to sort of dovetail into this encounter that Shadow has with a character who's not named in the episode, but is called the Technical Boy, who is, we've been talking about these old gods, and this is a new god. This is a god of technology. In the books, he's sort of like a, I think Dave Gonzalez called it trench coat mafia. Like a black trench coat wearing sort of overweight, pimply teenage boy, right? Like when Gaiman wrote this book, which was, what, 2001, I think?
That would have been like the sort of
vision of like Columbine hackers, video game players, blah blah. And the fact that he's been given
the trainers wearing upgrade.
The Silicon Valley upgrade is excellent. But you were talking about sort of the true sacrifice that we make, you know, that real humans once made to these gods. And mm-hmm. I think one of the brilliant things that Gaiman does in this book and that they're doing in this show. Is the stuff with the new gods, because if you've ever been with a group of people, or maybe this is just my experience, but my experience is that oftentimes when I'm in a group of people, sometimes someone completely disappears from the room because they've just fallen down their phone and they're just staring at their phone, and they are sacrificing human interaction, time spent with others, like all their sorts life. Of things, their life. They're giving hours of their life to their devices. You know, and we'll talk about some of the other new gods down the road, but yeah, this the technical boy, and what's interesting is in the book, I would say the technical boy is probably like the second most important new god, but now this many years later, 16 years later, mm-hmm. I would say the technical boy is the most powerful of the new gods in terms of what we devote ourselves to, and
I think that's it's sort of prophetic. I think a lot of people would have seen it coming at the time that the book was written, but at the same time, I would have to guess that that character, like you said, he's a significant character in the book, but he has got to get more screen time in the show, because that's like a documented problem in our current culture. Mm-hmm. And it's like it's having an effect on children's development. Like, that's what religion is too. It molds you.
Screen time is a thing. Like too much screen time, and it's linked to like autism and like the way we parcel it out, and sort of people limiting, putting their devices in drawers and putting them away so that they can like get their full nights of sleep or whatever it is. You know. So all these ways in which we have to sort of restrain ourselves from worshiping this technology and letting it sort of dictate the way we live our lives. Like we do. We have changed the way we live our lives because of most of us, probably people who listen to podcasts, so probably you guys listening, because of these devices that we're chained to. I'm certainly guilty of it. I'm not like preaching about it. I'm guilty of it. But, it's just definitely an observation that this show can make. Now, if you're watching this show and you haven't read the book, I can understand that you're just like, who's this kid in this limo and what and why? And what's the thing that flew on Shadow's face? And why is he there? And why isn't Shadow more freaked out about the fact that a thing flew at his face and now he's in the back of a limo with some kid smoking, what, toad skins out of a vape thing? Like, you know.
Which actually, in the book, he's also smoking toad skins.
Yes.
Synthetic toad skins. It's just that now he's vaping. Yeah. I really enjoyed, by the way, like sidebar, I really enjoyed the like piece of marketing materials like on the Twitter feed that came out of Stars that were just like, we get it, you vape, techno boy.
Once again, Shadow is just sort of sitting there calmly taking it all in, and I really, really like your interpretation, and I'm gonna glom onto it, of this, like, if I just hold very still, this isn't actually happening to me. Like, just keep still, Shadow Boy. You'll be fine.
Haven't you ever reached a point in your, like, you know, you've had a week? None of us have had a week quite like Shadow's week. No. Quite like Shadow's 24 hours.
Knock on wood. Yeah, we never will.
Knock on wood. But at the same time, like, I've definitely had, you know, a series of hours or days where you sort of reach a point where you're like, okay, sure. No, I won't fuck with you. Can I go now? Like, when is this going to stop? Oh, yeah. You're hitting me again? When is that going to stop? Like, it's just...
We've had this, and not to get too personal about our lives, we've had this conversation about, like, former bosses that we've had, right? Of, like, without naming any names for either of us, but just sort of, like, work relationships we've had where we felt like, how much abuse can I take? And, like, yeah, if I stay very calm and still, will it stop soon? So, yeah,
interesting. Right, yeah, and... Yeah, I just that scene in particular, and you know, not to get too close to the ending of the episode, but the ending of that scene was a deviation as well, where it did go precisely as poorly as Shadow could have imagined it would go, I think.
Right, where he winds up hanging from a tree. Let's talk about that.
Not beaten out of him by faceless Clockwork Orange drones. I have to tell you also, I was looking at the chapter in the book because I was like, oh, they're called the children. That's so weird. So I was looking back at the book and there are 206 children. Would someone please write in and explain to me why 206 children for Techno Boy is important? Because I know it is and I can't figure it out. And I tried for like an hour.
Oh, I have to wonder if it's like a coding thing. I was just rereading Snow Crash and he was talking about numbers and their significance to hackers. Yeah. So I wonder if like 206 is some sort of like, I just typed in 206 hacker and it gave me some movie that was made in 2016. Deeply unhelpful. Anyway.
A little lot of things to my shame. And
So, you know, if I echo Gil's plea, if you could let us know why the 206 is at all useful. But something that sort of Dave Gonzalez pointed out to me that I really like, one thing I know you know is that Odin is the hanging god. So the fact that sort of like Shadow is strung up here sort of feels significant to that. But also this idea of like lynching imagery, like, you know, because Shadow because Shadow is like a non-white American, which is important to the story, like, this fine American tradition of lynching people. So, you know, just sort of those hanging imagery, like that, those twin associations with hanging, and then the episode ends. We have one thing we have to circle back on, but the episode ends with, we don't know what, exploding the children in sort of like an echo of the Viking opening. We just have like a lot of blood flying up in the air. And our boy Shadow is rescued, right? So
yeah, it's just sort of, you know, spinal columns, and skulls everywhere.
skulls and spinal columns, as far as the eye can see. So the one thing we need to circle back on is the thing that gives the episode its title, The Bone Orchard, which is a dream or a vision that Shadow has on the plane, right? Probably. I forget where it comes on the episode, but where he sees this flaming-eyed buffalo. Which in the book is a buffalo man, like a man with a buffalo head.
Mini buffalo.
Yeah, mini buffalo. I think that's definitely their technical name. Minnow buffalo. So, you know, Shadow walks dreamlike through this bone orchard. You know, the ground is strewn with skeletons. The trees themselves have sort of like limbs that can grab you a la Wizard of Oz. And then he sees this flaming eyed buffalo voiced by Ian McShane, who says, you have to believe, right? In order to survive or something like that.
Yeah.
So that's a mystery, obviously, that we're not going to go too much into, but, some complaints I've gotten is that scene, Brian Fuller and director David Slade, who directed this episode, they're fond of the slow motion. So the slow-mo is a thing that they are fond of. Did you feel that sequence, you know, I should say for our listeners, you're also a brilliant artist as well as all the other things you do. was that scene to you visually engaging enough that you didn't mind that it took like 20 minutes for Shadow to walk through that orchard? Or did you feel like it was a little like, I will say this. I don't want to lead you. I will say, I feel like it's a little indulgent, that sequence. What did you think of it?
Actually, I didn't mind the slow walking. What I minded, because I minded things, was, first of all, the fact that there was very little depth. I mean, like literal, actual, perspective depth to the scene. And so it had a sort of odd Jim Henson's Labyrinth kind of fake tree construction to it. That was a little distracting to me. I wish that they had spent a little bit more time creating a better sense of vastness, but possibly it was intentional. The other thing about that scene that bothered me was the cut on his face that he gets from one of the trees. And this is maybe a personal thing that bugged me that nobody else was bothered by. It's just that anytime, you know, because this is such a mythologically oriented, I mean, this is all about mythology. It's all about, you know, groups of three and pacts and spells and trickery. Any exchange of blood or names is usually very significant. And so I thought that was just sort of a weird thing that they threw in there, that I don't remember being in any part of the book. Stop me if I'm wrong. But yeah, those two things for me were more distracting than the fact that it took a while. I didn't mind that. What bothered me about it was that it took a while to, in my opinion, not enough visual effect.
Mm. All right. So that is the first episode of American Gods. I'm gonna shoot three questions at you before we wrap up. What was your high point of the episode?
My high point of the episode.
I'll warn you next time when I'm going to ask you questions.
It was either Shadow's cellmate talking about gallows humor. I liked that sort of introduction to our theme. and it's just a very significant thing to say in general. That's the spoilery as I'll get. But I think really Ian McShane just telling that poor flight attendant that she was definitely going to bring him another drink and she wasn't going to take his drink away. And furthermore, she was going to bring another drink for his friend. I thought that was pretty well done. And it was sort of like charming in a, wow, you're such an asshole kind of way. Like, you must get away with this forever. Yeah. That's who you are. I thought that was well played because I was like bristled immediately at the whole thing, but I was just sort of like, yeah, well, I would probably bring you a drink too.
All right, and then your low point of the episode.
My low point of the episode. I think actually my low point of the episode was I had some confusion about the outcome of the fight, and it's possibly intentional, but you know, the outcome of the fight between Mad Sweeney and Shadow, he ends up with the coin, and I was under the impression, based on what we saw in the episode, that he had sort of grabbed the coin. Like, that wasn't something that he bargained for, that actually the fight was for the trick, to learn how to do the trick. And they did change that in the episode so that it was, no, the fight is for the coin.
Right.
And in the book, the fight is actually to determine for the trick that he pulls the coins out of the air. And Shadow wants him to teach him how he does it. And he doesn't believe that he's just pulling coins out of the air. And he, you know, Mad Sweeney sort of says, I tried to tell you when we first started talking, that is the trick. You won. You learned it. That's how I do it. So the coin, yeah, in my mind, you know, watching the episode was something extra. And I know that's sort of a weird low point to pick. It's just that I find it significant in the spoilery future.
I think they kind of whiffed that bar scene. As like visually cool as it was, as much as I actually do kind of like that Mad Sweeney character. I mean, I love him in the book and I like him in the show. And as much as I liked, loved the bartender waitress at the Crocodile Bar of Donnie Darko fame, I just thought that that scene did not play out the way, just as smoothly or land as well as I wanted it to.
Yeah.
Okay, and then my last question for you, without spoiling, so this is like a fun exercise in being like as oblique as you possibly can.
So circumspect.
What are you looking forward to?
Oh, okay.
That you can say without sort of...
that I can say
anything. You can be coy, coy as can be.
Here's what I am most looking forward to. There is a piece of the book we have not been introduced to yet in the series. And to be honest, I don't know if we will be, because it's one of these outlier stories. In the book, it has significance, but it would be easy to write it out of the story. There is a particular piece of mythology. It is very, very old, and it's just as dark as Odin mythology. And Gaiman loves it. He's brought it into other things that he's written. It's very poignant. And in the book, it was the single most horrible thing of all the gods, Odin included, everybody, and all of the dreadful sacrifices that people really did used to make to gods that they believed in. This is the worst one.
All right.
And it sort of slid into the book very quietly, very calmly, and it's revealed very, very late in the story. And I do hope that they find a way to work it into this series, but I will be honest with you, I am not hopeful for it. I found it one of the most moving things in the entire book. But as I said, it would be pretty easy to write out.
So you book readers who, like, don't know what Gail's talking about, will want to know what Gail's talking about, you can reach her on Twitter at Clockwork Rose and ask her directly, and she'll let you know exactly what she's talking about. You know, and for the rest of you, you just get to suffer along in the darkness with, you know, until you don't. Just like all of us mere mortals. But that is it for us, for this special episode of Storm of Spoilers, talking about American Gods Season 1, Episode 1, The Bone Orchard. We will be back next week with Episode 2. And please do send any of your questions that you have about the series in general, or this episode, or upcoming things, and we'll answer what we can to stormofspoilers@gmail.com, or you can tweet at me, at Joe Wrote This, or once again at Gail, to Gail at Clockwork Rose. And we will see you until next week. Only the gods are real.